91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Now that the boomer generation is emergent into old age and living longer than their ancestors, the numbers who face Alzheimer's and memory disorders have increased accordingly. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. This hour we visit with geriatric psychiatrist Dr. Mark Agronin. He's a vice president for behavior health and clinical research at Miami Jewish Health, where he works on diagnosis, treatment, and memory complaints. Dr. Agronin is also an associate professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Miami School of Medicine. We'll learn ways to build a better brain this hour after NPR and regional news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you today. It's Topical Currents. We're in our at-your-service mode today. The topic is how to build a better, older brain. As the boomer generation ages into the zone where cognitive impairment may become a health factor, Dr. Mark Agronin has insight.
Dr. Agronin is an adult and geriatric psychiatrist who's the medical director and vice president for mental health and clinical research at the Miami Jewish Health System.
It's Florida's largest long-term care institution. He's also an affiliate associate professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Miami School of Medicine.
His latest book is The Dementia Caregiver, A Guide to Caring for Someone with Alzheimer's Disease and Other Neurocognitive Disorders.
Of course, we'll be taking calls during the hour. Our number 1-800-743-9576. Welcome to you, Dr. Mark Agronin.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Welcome back. Why are these cases of Alzheimer's expected to double worldwide in the next 50 years? Is it because people are living longer? Is it just as simple as that? Or is there an increase in neurocognitive disorders worldwide?
The number one risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age. And so, on the one hand, the good news is that we're all living longer, healthier lifespans. The downside is that we're seeing a tremendous increase in the number of cases of Alzheimer's disease in particular, but also other forms of dementia or what we call neurocognitive disorders. If you turn the clock back 40, 50 years ago, most of individuals who suffered from dementia had what we call vascular dementia, so they had damage due to stroke. Now that we're doing a much better job of controlling those risk factors like high blood pressure, high glucose, people are getting more exercise, we're seeing fewer strokes, but the flip side, we're seeing more Alzheimer's disease. So it's really age. Aside from that, I wouldn't say we're seeing more of it because of anything about the disease itself.
On a basic level, what's the latest research on Alzheimer's, and is there hope?
We've developed a very clear model now that traces Alzheimer's disease back to two particular toxic proteins. One is called beta amyloid. Another is a form of tau protein.
And what?
Of tau. Tau is a protein, a normal protein within nerve cells in the brain. But in Alzheimer's disease, it becomes destabilized and it turns into a toxic form of it. And so what happens over time, and this is not just when someone walks in with symptoms, but this process begins decades before people develop symptoms, is you begin to get this buildup outside of your brain cells of this beta amyloid protein, and it forms these plaques throughout the brain. As that begins to spread, you get a destabilization within nerve cells in the brain of tau protein, and that forms these tangles in the brain. And so this accumulation of these proteins begin to damage the brain more and more so until finally you hit a tipping point where people begin to show symptoms.
When you say they get tangled and there are more and more of them in the brain, that's just anywhere in the brain or a specific area of the brain or areas?
It begins in an area of the brain called the hippocampus and the surrounding tissue, which is our memory processing center. And that's why short-term memory problems tend to be the very first symptom we see. But then it spreads throughout the entire cortex or upper regions of the brain. So this is why we call the symptoms of Alzheimer's a global condition, because even though it begins with memory, it eventually affects all of our higher functions, language, recognition, motor skills, organization, all of that in turn.
Is the term senility outdated?
We don't use that term anymore. It's an antiquated term. We're even starting to change use of the term dementia. The new term is neurocognitive disorder, It's a broader term. It doesn't have the same negative connotations that dementia has, and because there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. And I give the following example. If you went to your doctor and he said, well, you have an infection, you'd want to know what type of infection do I have. Similarly, if someone has a form of dementia or a neurocognitive disorder, meaning that they have brain damage causing cognitive changes, the question is, what type do you have? The most common type is Alzheimer's disease.
So you're learning about what causes it, these two proteins. You don't really have too much in the way of treatment yet, but we know how to prevent it.
Well, this
so
is the paradox.
It's a very interesting, incongruous notion that, I mean, do we really know how to stay it off?
Without question. This is the challenge of this disease. We've learned a tremendous amount within the last 15 to 20 years. We have a better understanding of the pathology behind it. We have a great understanding of the risk factors for it, age being number one, but things like diabetes, anything that can damage the heart can damage the brain. So we've gained this understanding. We have some symptomatic treatments for symptoms that help modestly, but the bottom line is that we do not have a cure. In the last 15 years, 99% of all clinical trials aimed at slowing this disease down have failed. But we do know, at least on one ray of hope, right, is the type of brain-healthy lifestyle that might not prevent it, but can certainly reduce your risk of getting Alzheimer's disease.
Which sounds exactly like you can prevent heart disease.
It is essentially identical.
Right.
And the good news is you don't need any special or secret pill or potion to do this. You don't have to become a triathlete. We know that modest exercise makes a difference. Walking 3 to 4 times a week for 45 to 60 minutes. Healthy diet, really similar to the Mediterranean diet. And a glass of wine, which is good news. But I emphasize one standard glass of wine. Some people like to enhance
not
that.
Not the big gulp.
No, that doesn't work.
I thought it was 2 for men and 1 for women.
Yeah, that information is not correct. But also keeping mentally and socially active. If you look at this lifestyle, it's one of enjoying life. It's doing things you like to do. People ask me all the time, well, do I have to do these computer games? Do I need to do crossword puzzles all the time? Do I need to engage in some crazy diet or exercise plan? I tell people, as long as you're active and busy and enjoying yourself, you're going to do it again and again. And that's really key, because if you start some crazy diet or program that you're not going to continue with, you're right, not going to get the benefit of it.
Do certain populations have a higher risk of getting Alzheimer's other than just old as we age?
Yeah, not inherently. This disease does not discriminate. It doesn't matter your background, your race, your religion. If you are in a group, either a cultural group or a geographic location where people tend to have more heart disease, you tend to see more brain disease. Mm-hmm. So it's really a matter of that. Lifestyle at the end makes all the difference. And so you look at any modern westernized country, you will see levels of Alzheimer's disease exploding.
So we're trying to encourage the plasticity of the brain. Should we learn a new language, take up a musical instrument, work crossword puzzles?
Brush our teeth with our other hand.
That's exactly what people should be doing, because that cross-trains your brain. If you go to the gym and all you do is work your biceps every time, you're going to have the best-looking arms, but the rest of your body is not going to look as good. It won't be as strong or as toned. Same thing with your brain. You want to work your memory, but you also want to work the other skills. And so just as you suggested, learning a new language, not so you'll be completely fluent with it, but just the act of doing something different with your brain, using a different hand to brush your teeth, reading different political tracks, listening to different type of music.
I think learning Latin is probably easier than brushing your teeth with the other hand.
That may be true for some people. If you enjoy learning Latin, then that's a perfect thing to do.
Okay.
I saw some material that suggested that the numeric mental abilities are among the first to fade, something like figuring out a tip at a restaurant or something.
Yeah, for some people, and it's sometimes more noticeable in someone who may have been an accountant or a mathematician, because they're more acutely aware of some of those changes. But it's really short-term memory that's affected first, because those are the region of the brain, those are the cells that this disease begins to attack first.
Are there reliable tests that can determine if we're having normal memory loss or if we're having, the beginnings of cognitive impairment?
This is a really important question, because all of us worry about memory changes.
Yeah.
And I'm increasingly seeing people in their 50s and 60s who are panic-stricken over memory lapses. It's common to have mild changes in memory and other cognitive abilities as we get older. Our brains slow down to some extent, but that's only part of the story. Most of the time, for younger people, it's not Alzheimer's disease that's causing this. It's lots of reversible factors: lack of sleep, depression, stress, adult attention disorder, too much alcohol, factors like that. And so often we can reassure people, but we find other reasons that they need to focus on. And that earlier intervention is key in order to catch something that may be causing damage over time.
So there are tests that you can actually take? I mean, how do you determine if it's a problem or just normal?
Yeah, this is an essential question to know. Is it normal change or not? This is where we've made great strides. 10, 15 years ago, we really had to listen to someone's story. We ruled out other causes, and we tried to make a good guess. Nowadays, we have more sophisticated brain scans. We can do detailed cognitive testing. We can analyze your spinal fluid. These tests allow us to get much closer to making a diagnosis, because the challenge is as follows. If you look at what Alois Alzheimer did back in 1905 for the first write-up in the literature about this case, he took a piece of brain tissue, he stained it, and he found these plaques and tangles in it. That's the only way still today
that we
can make a 100% diagnosis, but we do have new types of scans, a new type of PET scan that can actually identify the presence of amyloid protein in the brain, and so it gets us much closer to making a certain diagnosis.
What would spinal fluid reveal?
That protein?
Yeah, in spinal fluid, we look for a certain ratio of beta amyloid to tau protein. And depending on the ratio, tells us whether there are more or less of these, because there are other types of dementia that involve tau protein.
We're speaking with Dr. Mark Agronin. He is a geriatric psychiatrist and medical director and vice president for mental health and clinical research at Miami Jewish Health Systems. And we're going to be talking about his book in a bit as well. But for now, we're just going to take a short break. Again, our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576, or email is radio@wlrn.org.
Minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation with Dr. Mark Agronin. He's a geriatric psychiatrist. If you'd like to join in, once again, our number, 1-800-743-9576. We're at your service today. Also, email, that's radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. Please keep those emails brief.
Dr. Agronin is a nationally recognized expert in psychiatric illnesses in the elderly, but he's also an author, and his latest book is The Dementia Caregiver, A Guide to Caring for Someone with Alzheimer's Disease and Other Neurocognitive Disorders. So what I wanted to ask you about that is the most effective way for caregivers to get the care they need. Is the first step convincing a caregiver that they need care?
That's a good point, because the caregivers are often so focused on the person that they're helping with that they don't take good care of themselves. And so in our memory center, for example, we spend time addressing them alone and making certain that we talk about their own lifestyle issues. We know that caregivers suffer from more medical problems. They suffer from more depression, and they even have higher mortality rates, which is really alarming. So it's critical that they get support, that they get educated about this disease, that they're hooked in with resources, and especially that they have respite time, time away, breaks. They need people to help. And unfortunately, too often I see when individuals suffer from Alzheimer's disease that they're abandoned by friends and family. People are afraid of it. They don't know what to do. They feel they can catch it, none of which is the case. But then caregivers are really left bereft.
You think it's because they're afraid they can catch it? Isn't it also that it reminds them of their own aging and their own mortality, or the fact that they could get it, and that scares them?
Without question, there are multiple elements. I sometimes look at Alzheimer's disease today the way we looked at cancer in the 50s. People really have a fear of it. They become superstitious if they can catch it. But you're right, it also reminds them of what they could face as they get older. And so they don't want to be around it.
There's some numbers I read. I don't know if you put out, the AARP and then the National Council on Aging or whatever, that about 34.2 million Americans provide unpaid care to an adult, half of whom care for someone who has some form of dementia, and with their services valued at around $217 million. Is that per year?
Yes, and it's actually over $200 billion. If you look at the cost, billion to the economy, it is taking
an enormous they also have lost wages.
Yes, if you put together healthcare costs, long-term care costs, as well as the loss of productivity, it's enormous, costing our country now over $200 billion. Mm. If we don't have a cure by 2050, this will crest over $1 trillion. And what's alarming is that Alzheimer's disease is the single most expensive disease in this country, more so than heart disease, more than cancer. And yet, in comparison, we are not putting in enough resources. We spend about $10 billion a year in research for heart disease and cancer, which is money well spent. In contrast, we don't even spend $1 billion on research for Alzheimer's disease. It's really only been in the last year or two that this money has increased. And so if we're not putting in those resources, if we're not getting enough people into research, we simply will not make progress. This is a difficult disease, a complex pathology, and it's very slow progress. But all of us are heading into those waters, and we need to find a cure, without question.
Getting back to caregivers, in so many cases, there's really no choice but to sort of be enslaved by it. They're in a room with no doors.
The average caregiver is an older female spouse who themselves may have health issues. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it can be you're essentially chained to the person 24/7 if they are in moderate to advanced stages, because they need constant supervision. They need help with dressing, with feeding, with supervision of activities. So it's an enormous burden for people, which is why we need to get them hooked up with a memory center, with experts. We need to get resources involved. There's a tremendous number of resources
in the
community.
Well, let's talk about some of the resources that are available. You have the memory center at Miami Jewish Health.
Yes, we have a memory center. There are other memory centers in the community throughout Broward and Dade County. The reason it's important to be connected to a memory center is because you can work with a team of experts who know this disease inside and out. It's always a good place to start with your internist. Your internist or primary care physician can manage the day-to-day medical issues. But just as you'd go to a cardiologist for a heart issue or a podiatrist for a foot issue, you should go to either a geriatric psychiatrist or a neurologist with a specialty in dementia for this condition, because then you'll get the best treatment, you'll get access to research and clinical trials, you'll get social workers, psychologists, other people to help out, and that makes all the difference. The Alzheimer's Association is also a great resource in the community. They have a hotline. You can get into support groups. Caregivers need to educate themselves about this disease. This is not a race. This is a marathon. The average course lasts 8 to 12 years. So it's not something that within a couple months or a year that you can focus on. It's long-term, and you need those supports along the way.
Let's take a telephone call or two. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. First up, Coral Springs caller, Roy. Hey, Roy, go ahead.
Yes, doctor, thank you for taking my call. I was reading a lot about auditory deprivation, where a person would have a hearing loss for a long period of time. And these studies indicate that this may attribute to dementia. And I'm wondering if you have come across this, to find this to be true or not. And a part of the question also would be, if indeed hearing loss can cause or lead to Alzheimer's or dementia, can wearing hearing aids help offset that?
Hearing loss per se is not a risk factor for dementia. There might be some underlying cause of the hearing loss that could cause other sorts of brain damage, but I wouldn't have people who have hearing loss worry that this is going to somehow lead to or be associated with dementia. What I would say is, if someone can't hear, they're not going to remember what's being told to them. And so it's just a factor of daily life that can certainly impair the quality of life and make a memory problem seem worse. But I wouldn't list it as a cause or a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia.
Okay, thanks for your call, Roy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roy.
Doctor, how about brain tonics, supplements? Is there any evidence of effectiveness there?
The short answer is no. There are a lot of different pills, potions, tonics being sold, none of which have any evidence that they truly improve memory, certainly not that they prevent, help treat Alzheimer's disease. The key is to look at, has the medication passed muster with the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA? You need to have studies that show in people with Alzheimer's disease or with the condition that they actually get better, they have benefit on the medication. If not, it's not worth the money. And, you know, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars today trying to find more effective treatments. That's what we need to focus on. People should focus their resources on things that help them make a difference rather than on what are, in essence, forms of snake oil.
I think this is important. We talked about it a little before the show, but you talk about medications and other conditions that can cause cognitive impairment, but it's not dementia or Alzheimer's. It happens to be too many opioids or too many benzodiazepines or what else?
There are lots of different conditions and medications that can worsen memory, whether you have an underlying dementia or not.
Right.
And so this is why an early comprehensive evaluation is important, where we look at the whole medical history, the psychiatric history. We look at things like depression, which can worsen memory if someone has less concentration, less interest. We look for whether they're drinking too much. What medications are they taking? Are they taking too many narcotic painkillers, sleeping pills, steroids, other medications that can impair memory? And sometimes there are other, we do a brain scan because sometimes someone can have stroke, a bleed from an injury, a benign tumor that can impair memory as well. And the earlier you catch it, the more you can treat it and sometimes cure, reverse the condition. Alzheimer's disease is different because that's a progressive condition that we can't cure.
And it's not reversible.
It's not reversible. But what I emphasize is that the course is worse when you layer onto it all these other factors. So someone may have Alzheimer's disease, but if they're also depressed or they're drinking too much or they're taking too many painkillers, that can make the condition much worse than it needs to be. And this is, again, why management is so important. People become very fatalistic, and they say, well, it's Alzheimer's disease. There's nothing we can do, so no need to be followed. And that could not be further from the truth.
Okay.
Because you want, again, this is 8, 10, 12-year course, sometimes longer. And we want to give this person the best quality of life possible.
Depression is so common, and antidepressants are being prescribed, you know, probably at record rates. Do those link in with, you're saying depression can maybe exacerbate cognitive impairment? What about the medications for depression?
If someone is suffering from a true depression, medications can certainly help, but they need to be managed by someone who has an expertise in that area.
Like a psychiatrist.
Yes. And you're right that lots of people use too many medications. They're used inappropriately. They're not dosed correctly. And that's why you want someone who has an expertise in that area to really manage it, because then it can make a difference. Some people believe that certain antidepressants can actually help cognition. I'm not in that school. I use them if someone has anxiety, depression, agitation that's getting in the way of their quality of life.
Okay.
We'll take another caller, Maria. Maria in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I actually wanted to know if you had any type of feedback regarding management of patients that are starting to show early signs of some type of dementia but have not been diagnosed yet. For example, I'm having a hard time with my mom, taking her to a specialist or somebody that's an expert on the matter. I've been noticing a lot of changes in personality and just our overall cognitive function, and she kind of refuses to go anywhere. She's actually more on the aggressive side. How would you approach a patient like this?
This is an important question, and it can be very challenging because without question, your mom and someone in that situation needs a comprehensive evaluation. Lots of times individuals, especially with Alzheimer's disease in early stages, they don't have good insight into what's going on. So other people recognize the problem, they don't, and so sometimes they're resistant to treatment. In those situations, they might not immediately go to a memory center or a neurologist, but they often will go to see their family doctor, and so at least you can talk to that doctor ahead of time, explain the situation so they understand, because if they don't see it, they might speak out of turn or reassure the person unnecessarily, but have them ahead of time make certain at least they check blood levels of standard conditions, that they get a brain scan done. At least if they start with that, you can get the process going.
Would Maria have to come up with some other reason to take her mom to the doctor?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes you have to do that.
That's actually my problem. Like, I've tried. I even made an appointment for her. It was like a 3-month process, and the day literally before the test, she refused to go. She's like, there's nothing wrong with me. You're imagining things. You're not. And everybody in the family kind of agrees. We're a very close family, my brother and myself.
What about Maria, just if it's time for her annual checkup?
I could, I guess, look at it that way. Her primary care physician is actually a friend of the family.
Oh.
You don't need to tell her. Yeah, I mean, she needs an annual checkup.
And she works, it's funny because she works at a physician's office. She's a medical assistant. So I've talked to him, and even a brain scan, I think, would actually help, or some type of cognitive test that they could conduct. But it's that she refuses. And like I said, she's gotten to the point where she's gotten very aggressive every time I bring up the subject. And it's so difficult because we all see it except for her.
However you and the family can get her into the doctor is so important, because you'd hate to find out years down the line that there's something completely reversible that could be treated now. But a few years from now, the damage could be irreversible. So you almost need an intervention with family members if you can't get her in for just a routine checkup. But it's important. And I tell people, if your child had some medical condition, they refuse to go to the doctor, you'd pick them up and drag them in. Now, you can't do that with your mom necessarily, although, you know, if you get the family together and you're insistent and you set it up, sometimes, I find in most situations, people will back down and they'll say, okay, you know, they'll go along with you, so.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go that route.
Okay, Maria.
Good luck, Maria.
Okay. Good luck, Maria. We're speaking with Dr. Mark Agronin. He's a nationally recognized expert in psychiatric illnesses. He's an author, and he's the geriatric psychiatrist and medical director for mental health and clinical research at Miami Jewish Health Systems or Services?
No, just Miami Jewish Health.
Just Miami Jewish Health. Okay, and actually their website is miamijewishhealth.org. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman and Dr. Mark Agronin. We continue our discussion about dementia and Alzheimer's and caregivers as well. Doctor, I was reading some of the material, and they were talking about virtual reality to enhance the life of some oldsters. Are we going to be getting into that kind of technology?
Well, I think virtual reality needs to be developed more and adapted for older people. Right now, the big focus is on gaming, which will not be as applicable. I think that the term I like is integral reality, where someone doesn't necessarily walk around with a big headset and headphones on, but if you can feed information, let's say to a visor or glasses that could give someone prompts as they're walking around their environment, I think that would be helpful.
Such as what?
To remind them, give them cues where to go.
Where you're parked.
Where your car is.
Although, if you're still driving,
if someone needs a visor, maybe they shouldn't be driving.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But for instance, you could envision walking into a kitchen, and as you pass by certain cabinets, a word lights up on the cabinet that tells you what's in it or what food is in it, things like that. Or if you need help or assistance, there are just cues surrounding you that you can activate.
To turn off the stove.
Things like that. We don't have that available yet. But my guess is that will come quickly. But to me, when we think of virtual reality, I think that will be more applicable.
We have an emailer, Bradley. I understand there may be a correlation with high cholesterol or high triglycerides and Alzheimer's, which there is, correct?
Yes, it's the same issue of what's bad for the heart is bad for the brain.
He says, is there also a correlation with people not getting enough sleep? Excuse me.
Well, without question, sleep disorders are common in late life, and they can certainly worsen memory, they can worsen energy during the day. So sleep disorders are not a cause per se of dementia. They're not a cause of Alzheimer's disease, but they're a factor that can make a person's cognition and their overall quality of life worse. And so that's why we encourage what we call good sleep hygiene, so good sleep habits. And when we're suspicious of a condition, we get people to for a sleep evaluation.
Okay. And okay. All right.
And back to our callers, Carmen. Carmen in Tamarack. Hi there.
Hi. Good afternoon. I'd just like to share, I'm a senior, and I go to the Humana Center in Tamarack. And what you're touching on memory, and we have it in the form of, we have seminars there. There's a small room, and we just make awareness to everybody as far as Alzheimer's and dementia and even heart-healthy kind of diet. So the focus is every day they do something, and even puzzles and coloring. So for myself and other ladies, it's really godsend, because it's just making you aware.
That's a great program.
Yes.
It's keeping you busy, keeping you active. Adult education is wonderful.
Yes.
It's important.
I just wanted to share that.
That's a great program.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And we'll move along now to Milton in Boca Raton. Milton, hi.
Hi, this is Milton, living in Boca Raton. I have been diagnosed with amyloidosis AL. I've been treated with chemotherapy, and thank God my disease is under control. I no longer have any treatment for it. However, it has damaged my kidneys. I have renal amyloidosis, but that's another story. But I hear you using the word amyloid quite often, and I'm concerned. Am I to be concerned in any way extra, so to speak, regarding getting Alzheimer's or some kind of dementia because I have some form of an amyloid disorder?
You're describing a different type of disorder with a different form of amyloid. And so amyloid is a protein that can cause different diseases. It sounds like you're describing it affecting more your body, so from the neck on down.
Yeah.
Whereas with Alzheimer's disease, we're talking about a very specific protein called beta amyloid. The fact that, you know, you have such a good and keen understanding of this and are describing to this tells me that this sounds more like it's been a bodily and not a mind issue for you.
So I would
reassure you on that account.
Okay, I'll keep exercising.
That's important.
Thanks,
Milton. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful program. Your programs are just marvelous. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Emilio wants to know what role high-fat Western diets play in brain scarring, which ultimately leads to diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. Wouldn't the adoption of a plant-based diet that excludes animal products in processed foods reduce brain scarring and the prevalence of diseases such as these?
It's the same theme that what's good or bad for the heart is good or bad for the brain.
But some people, we did a show, Joe, where they were saying fat is really good for you?
Well, genetics plays a role here, too. Some individuals are more prone to having fatty buildup in arteries, which can be in your heart or your brain. Other people not. And so it's not a one-size-fit-all condition. But in general, if you look at areas in the earth on the planet where people live longer, they tend to have more of a plant-based diet or tend to eat less red meat. But it doesn't mean you have to suddenly become a vegetarian, and that's going to prevent Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
So I certainly never recommend any radical dietary changes.
You mentioned genetics. Does this have a genetic component that you know of?
Yes. We look at it in two ways. Most people have late onset Alzheimer's disease, so after the age of 65, and we know of certain genetic risk factors, but we don't know of specific genetic causes of it. And so, for instance, you may have certain genes that you elevate your risk, but it doesn't mean you're going to get it. Whereas in early onset familial Alzheimer's disease, there are family groupings where if you get that particular genetic mutation, you will get the disease.
Oh.
And so those families, because we know they get it early on, they get it before the age of 65, there's a lot of intensive study of these family groupings because we can apply treatments like immunotherapy that we're doing now to them before they get it to see can we head it off. There's a wonderful PBS special which looked at one particular study in family groups in Colombia to see if this will work.
Long ago, we had a guest on who wrote a book called The Thousand-Yard Stare about his family, that almost all of the siblings had early-onset Alzheimer's in their 30s.
There are family groupings like that, but you know about it if you're in a family like that. It's tragic because people get it early on. Sometimes it tends to have a little bit more of a rapid course. But again, those families we are studying to try to really learn what causes this and how we can stop it.
Dr. Marco Gronin is a geriatric psychiatrist and medical director for mental health and clinical research at Miami Jewish Health. He also is the director of the Memory Center there, and he's an affiliate associate professor of psychiatry and neurology at U of M Miller School of Medicine. We'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman at your service this afternoon. We're speaking with Dr. Mark Gronin. He's an adult and geriatric psychiatrist and also the medical director for mental health and clinical research at Miami Jewish Health. Bonnie, you had an emailer?
Yes. Jan's brother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's with PCA 2 years ago, but had symptoms since 5 years ago. He's 62 years old now. Is there any new information on this type of Alzheimer's?
Well, he's referring to a variant of Alzheimer's called posterior cortical atrophy. We know that there appear to be different subtypes of Alzheimer's disease, but at the end of the day, we're using the same approaches. What I would recommend, especially someone who's younger, is definitely look into clinical trials.
Okay.
There are lots of different research sites around Broward and Dade counties.
How do you find those?
Well, most memory centers, for instance, are the Memory Center at Miami Jewish Health. We do clinical trials. Most other memory centers also conduct them. The Alzheimer's Association has a program called Trial Match. If you go to their website, you can type in information. It will tell you what studies are being conducted close to you. If we don't get people in clinical trials, we will not find a cure. And often these trials can give people access to more testing. They can get this type of PET scan for free if it's covered by the test. They can get access to treatments that are experimental but may offer some promise above and beyond what's on the market now.
When you do these kind of research clinical trials, do some people get placebos and other people get the medicine?
In almost every trial, it's placebo controlled. We really need to know, does the active treatment work better than a placebo? So unfortunately, there's no way around that.
So some people are not going to get the medication.
Some people won't.
Or they will at a later date.
They could at a later date. Some trials have what's called open label phase. So let's say it's an 18 or 24-month trial. At the end of that, then everyone gets the real thing.
Are you doing any clinical trials yourself now?
Yes. We have close to 20 actively enrolling clinical trials addressing just about every element of this disease. Big focus is on immunotherapy, where we give people antibodies to try to attack and break up this amyloid in the brain. I tell people when you come for a clinical trial, it's almost like VIP medicine, but without the charge, because they have 24/7 access to me as the principal investigator. We have a whole team of people they can get help from and resources from. There's no cost due to be in a trial. You continue with all your other doctors, with all your other medications. So lots of advantages to
be involved.
Yeah, why not? So how would one find out about these?
Well, for instance, with us, we have a hotline people can call. It's 305-514-8710. Or you can, if you Google memory centers in the area, you can go to the Alzheimer's Association website and look for their trial match program. There's something called clinicaltrials.gov, which is a little more difficult because it covers every clinical trial going on. You really want something local. And you often, in newspaper, radio, Facebook, there are often ads about different trials going on. So,
well, we'll have a link to that hotline on our website, WLRN.org. And say the number again.
305-514-8710. And Elizabeth Suarez will answer, and she is a warm, friendly person who really will explain what a study is about. She'll take down information, and then we will guide them to what studies are possible. And sometimes people, we just have them come in and we talk about it. There's no obligation to come in.
Okay.
Let's take another caller, Paula in Dania Beach. Paula, you're up. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Gronin, everybody. I love you all and your show. I can be very brief. After listening to the last talk, does OCD and Tourette syndrome play any role in getting Alzheimer's?
OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder, and Tourette syndrome, which is a tic disorder, do not cause Alzheimer's disease. They're not risk factors for it. They're definitely associated with other psychiatric illnesses, but not specifically with Alzheimer's disease.
So
but certainly people...
A 67-year-old woman with those problems who's getting Alzheimer's can't, you know, blame or think there's anything with getting Alzheimer's to do with those things, right?
Not on those conditions, no.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Okay, Josh wants to know if long-term use of oxycodone and Adderall cause memory or other brain deterioration.
Well, oxycodone as a narcotic painkiller absolutely can cause cognitive changes, although not dementia per se, but it can cause lots of issues if you're taking too much of it or not using it appropriately. Adderall or amphetamine will not cause memory loss. Sometimes it's used for treatment of attention deficit disorder, certain sleep issues, and sometimes we use it to stimulate people who have apathy as a result of dementia.
Oh, okay. So it's actually, that's definitely not going to...
Not going to cause it, no.
Right.
No.
And next caller, Savannah in Delray Beach. Hi there.
Hi. I am calling. I'm a member of a Huntington's disease support group and charity, and Huntington's disease shares a lot of the symptoms that you were mentioning earlier of Alzheimer's, dementia, and cognition and apathy that you just mentioned. But it is different as far as the age of onset, which is normally on average in the 30s and 40s. I'm wondering if there's any resources in the area for people in this age group, either assisted living facilities or just day services, because most of what I found so far that we recommend has been for people in the senior citizen group.
One challenging aspect is that most individuals with Huntington's disease tend to be younger, and they have a lot of unique needs and challenges, which sometimes go above and beyond what some of the dementia support groups provide.
There's also no known cure for that, too.
There's unfortunately no known cure for that. Nonetheless, I would say most long-term facilities, including Miami Jewish Health, certainly treat individuals with Huntington's disease. There is a national organization that you can get at least lots of information on about this. And when it comes to caregiving, a lot of the caregiving issues are the same. And so caregiver support groups can also be helpful as well.
Okay, good luck, Savannah. Thanks.
Thank you,
Thank
Savannah.
You.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ivan started a vegan, no-oil diet as recommended by Forks Over Knives documentary to see if it would improve his cholesterol and LDLs, which helped immediately. However, the naturopath doctor insists on taking coconut oil to help the brain. And now I'm confused. Does coconut oil have ill effects on our arteries but good for the brain?
This is a good example of science which is not... has not caught up with...
Gone awry.
Which is... I'm trying to say it in a nice way, but... there's no evidence that coconut oil will make a difference here. I will tell you that, for instance, there's a medical food product that has been studied which, like coconut oil, provides the body with fatty acids that can be converted to ketones that your brain can use as a fuel source. It's been studied in Alzheimer's. But even with that, the data has not been convincing. So the problem with something like coconut oil is there's no good evidence on it. You don't know what the dosing is. And you're right. You're putting a lot of excess fat into your body with uncertain benefit.
Okay. There's that answer, Ivan. And Jim says, considering the cost of providing manageable cost activities, my question pertains to the benefits of reading and the limitations that some elderly have with eye and vision symptoms. Is reading a positive benefit for people with early dementia? And is there a noticeable difference between persons that read by themselves or those that are members of book clubs? Is the audiobook alternative a sufficient substitute with similar benefits? And can patients benefit from caregivers' regular reading sessions?
For this, I would answer this by substituting lots of different activities for the word reading. For some people, reading is great, others not. My caution would be as people begin to develop symptoms of this, sometimes reading can become more difficult and frustrating for them. And again, at the end of the day, we're looking for a good quality of life. So I try to steer people towards activities that they enjoy, that they can still do comfortably.
Well, what about audiobooks, as he mentions? Do they lose their ability to concentrate?
It depends on the person. Certainly, the ability to listen and enjoy an audiobook might last longer than the ability to read. But eventually that's difficult. I would say music.
You might forget the definition of words.
Yeah, and then it becomes frustrating for someone. I think music is a better approach at that point.
Okay.
Even in later stage of the disease, music can be a wonderful way to get
soothing
people
and
soothe or get them stimulated, get them activated.
Okay.
Okay, George in Fort Lauderdale, you're up. Hi. George.
Okay. I couldn't, there was a break there. Hello. Are we on?
Yes, go ahead, George.
Okay. I would like to know again about, I heard earlier about alcohol being a factor, but my father died in 2002, and he first showed symptoms in 1997, and then, so that was like 5 years. And but I at that time I was told, or I researched, that the lifespan is usually 10 years after, or not more than 10 years after a diagnosis. But so, and he was a flight
engineer.
George,
excuse me, yes. George, we're almost out of time, so
okay.
We just need to get to the question. I'm sorry.
Okay, the question is how much, because he drank, you know, for a while, but then he quit the last couple of years of his life. How much alcohol is really, is too much? I mean, he would sit, after he retired, he would sit and drink.
Okay.
Sure. Well, okay. It's difficult to say. There's no question, as I said, one glass of wine or alcohol can help reduce the risk factor, but too much is not going to help. And the course is variable. So I would say maybe that his course could have been accelerated by the because of the alcohol use.
Yeah. Well, that will do it for today. We're sorry to the callers and emailers we couldn't get to. Dr. Mark Agronin is a geriatric psychiatrist, medical director, and vice president for mental health and clinical research at Miami Jewish Health, where he also is the director of the Memory Center. He's an affiliate professor of psychiatry and neurology at the U of M School of Medicine. And his latest book is, and for caregivers out there, is The Dementia Caregiver, a Guide to Caring for Someone with Alzheimer's Disease and Other Neurocognitive Disorders. And we'll have links to MiamiJewishHealth.org and the hotline on our website. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And that's our At Your Service edition. The program was produced by Richard Ive. Technical supervision by online director Jason Zapka. Polly Landis is associate producer. Perhaps you'd like someone close to you to hear this program. It's easy to download or link it through our website, WLRN.org. Follow the radio link. Also, there's the Topical Currents Facebook page as well as the iTunes podcasts. Tomorrow, it's a Topical Currents visit by Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. His most recent post was as Police Chief of Aurora, Colorado, but he's a veteran of the New York City Police Department as well, as a Deputy Chief and Executive Officer. A Topical Currents profile with Miami Beach Chief of Police Daniel Oates. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.